Let me just remind you what is going on here in this book of Habakkuk. In verses 2 to 4 of chapter 1, Habakkuk complains to God about the situation in Judah, about the wickedness, about the depravity there in the land. Particularly, remember, he highlights the violence that's going on in Judah, and he highlights the injustice, the perversion of justice that is going on in the land. So that's verses 2 to 4. Then in verses 5 to 11, God responds to Habakkuk's complaint about Judah, and his response is there in verse 6, I am raising up the Chaldeans. That's how he's going to deal with his dysfunctional people, Judah. He's going to do so by raising up the Chaldeans. And in those verses 5 to 11, God talks, you remember, about the ruthlessness and about the brutality of this instrument that he's going to use to deal with his rebellious people. The Chaldeans or the Babylonians, they are going to be this tremendously ruthless and brutal tool in God's hands. So that's verses 2 to 11 briefly recapped. And what we have now in verses 12 to 17 is Habakkuk adding his own reflections on the Chaldeans' ruthlessness and brutality. God has described their ruthlessness and brutality in verses 5 to 11. Here in these verses, Habakkuk adds his own reflections on that same theme, which means that these verses are probably written a few years later than the verses we were looking at last week, because at that point, you remember, we said the Chaldeans, it seems from verse 5, they're still very much a speck on the horizon. They haven't really emerged yet onto the stage of world history, and Habakkuk and the rest of Judah are going to be astounded, therefore, by this report of their advance. But now, here in verses 12 to 7, Habakkuk is clearly very aware of the Babylonians and what they are like. So that indicates then that things have moved on a bit. Habakkuk is writing now a few years later. And you'll notice then that the heading in the ESV above our passage, above verses 12 to 17, is Habakkuk's second complaint, which suggests that the tone here is somewhat similar to verses 2 to 4. That was his first complaint. Now, in verses 12 to 17, we have another section of the same order as that. This is his second complaint. And indeed, the commentators on this book tend to jump on that bandwagon. They tend to sum up the flow of chapter 1 here in terms of the prophet kind of sinking further and further into the depths of bewildered outrage. So he's pretty distressed at the outset at what's going on around him in Judah, but then, having heard from God about the Chaldeans, he's now utterly at his wit's end at the preposterousness of the whole thing. And he's basically saying, Yahweh, you can't punish wicked Judah using even wickeder Babylon. That's just not on. It's unfair. It's inappropriate. That's the standard summary of this chapter. But I don't think that's quite an accurate summary of the chapter. Three quick comments in that connection. So comment number one, in actual fact, the tone in verses 12 to 17 is considerably calmer than it was in verses 2 to 4. Remember how in verses 2 to 4, you have those three anguished questions, one after another. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity and why do you idly look at wrong? Question after question. Habakkuk clearly is in a state of real agitation there. There's nothing really that compares to that here in verses 12 to 17. This passage is twice as long as that one, but there are only two genuine questions, one in verse 13 and one in verse 17. The one in verse 12 is a rhetorical question. It's really a statement. You are from everlasting, my Lord, my Holy One. So that's the first thing to point out here, that the tone here in this second complaint is actually a lot calmer than in the first. Comment number two, to the extent that Habakkuk is troubled here in verses 12 to 17, It's not because he views Judah's punishment, Judah's coming punishment at the hands of the Babylonians, as excessive or out of proportion to her crime or anything like that. As I'll explain in greater detail in a moment, Habakkuk actually isn't worried about Judah. He isn't worried about Judah. His concern in this passage isn't God's people being badly done by or endangered or whatever. His concern rather is God's world being so broken by evil and inhumanity. It's the plight of mankind, verse 14, in the face of the Chaldeans' butchery that Habakkuk laments. And the haunting question with which our passage closes there in verse 17 is this: is he then to keep on emptying his net? That's Babylon being personified as one individual. Is he to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? Nations generally, nations in the world at large. Habakkuk's main concern here is not for Judah. He's not worried about Judah, and we'll talk about that more. His main concern is for God's creation, God's world, in which monstrous superpowers like Babylon can create such havoc. And let's just pause there for a moment and feel the challenge to ourselves of Habakkuk's attitude here. Are we troubled by the evil and humanity that's so prevalent in our world today and that consigns the lives of many, many, many human beings to such deprivation and misery? Does it bother us what Putin is doing in Ukraine, making Ukrainian towns and villages and families pay so dearly for his expansionist ambitions? And regardless of our political views on the Middle East, does both the Hamas attack on October the 7th and the flattening of Gaza by Israel in response bother us? If we believe that this is God's world and that human beings are God's image bearers, then such things should bother us. Being disturbed by violence and bloodshed and humanitarian crises, that's not the territory of Greenpeace activists and social justice warriors. That's the territory of Christian believers who stand in the tradition of biblical giants like Habakkuk. He here is disturbed just by the violence and bloodshed that Babylon is going to inflict on the nations generally. Godless nations, pagan nations, uncircumcised nations, heathen nations. But he's bothered. He's bothered by that. It troubles him. It disturbs him. And you and I should likewise be troubled in a world where such things happen. And then comment number three. While Habakkuk is troubled in the way that I've just described, and to some extent his concluding question, will Babylon mercilessly kill nations forever, is a genuine question, which God actually will answer in the following chapter, it's also true that Habakkuk knows the answer to that question. He knows that the answer is no. Babylon won't go on killing nations forever. For those with the eyes to see it, that answer is written all over verses 12 to 17. And our approach then in the rest of this evening's sermon is going to be this. We're going to ask three times verse 17's question. Will the Chaldeans mercilessly kill nations forever? And three times we're going to answer that question, no, but the answer will have a different emphasis each time. So here goes then, will the Chaldeans mercilessly kill nations forever? Answer number one, no, because of the nation that eludes Chaldean ambition. No, because of the nation that eludes Chaldean ambition. You see, if the Chaldeans were to mercilessly kill nations forever, they would eventually have killed them all, wouldn't they? And doubtless that was their ambition, to conquer the world, destroying every single nation everywhere in the process. But that cannot happen, because there's one nation, Habakkuk says, that they won't be able to kill. And that nation is Judah. Look at that confident line toward the middle of verse 12. We shall not die. Talking about Judah. We shall not die. We shall not mercilessly be killed by the Chaldeans. Whatever happens to many, many other nations, we won't go down that route. We shall not be killed by them. And actually, the last part of verse 12 is really making the same point. He says there, you have established them, that is the Chaldeans, for reproof. That's an interesting word. The Hebrew word there translated reproof is a very positive word in the Old Testament. It refers to God's beneficial disciplining and chastising. So that I think that line follows on very naturally from we shall not die. Habakkuk is saying we shall not die because you haven't established them for our destruction, but rather for our reproof, for our disciplining, and for our chastising. That's why I said then a moment ago, Habakkuk isn't worried about Judah. He's worried about other nations being cruelly wiped out by the savage Chaldeans. But he isn't worried about Judah because Judah won't be wiped out. Judah won't die. Judah will elude Chaldean ambition to devour all the nations. How can Habakkuk be so sure of that? How can he be so confident? I mean, at a purely military level, there's every reason to believe the Chaldeans will finish off Judah. They're a vastly greater power. And not only that, but on the face of things, at the theological level too, there's every reason to believe they'll finish off Judah. After all, the whole reason God is raising the Chaldeans up is because of Judah's present wickedness. So how is Habakkuk so confident that the Chaldeans will not kill Judah? They'll not wipe out Judah. They'll not finish off Judah. Well, I think the basis of his confidence is hinted at in a couple of the titles that he uses for God. First of all, the title Rock, verse 12. Oh, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. It's not an uncommon title in the Old Testament. You'll be familiar with it, especially in the Psalms, also in Deuteronomy. I hope it goes without saying that it's a metaphor rather than a literal description of God. The gods of the other nations were literally rocks or something similar. But of course, in the case of Yahweh, this is only a metaphor. He's not actually a rock. But if that doesn't need to be said, what perhaps does need to be said is that we have to be careful with metaphors. I mentioned this morning that some modern reform people seem to see God as rock-like when it comes to emotions, i.e. he doesn't have any. He's impassive and he's unfeeling. He's just like a rock. That's not what this metaphor is about. Rather, the point is, God is like a rock in his permanence and in his stability and in his reliability. I suppose the opposite metaphor would be a weather vane. A weather vane turns and changes according to the wind. A rock doesn't. Winds can blow and storms can rage across a coastline, across a beach, but a rock remains through them all. And what's the significance of the title here then in verse 12? Well, this is the thing. God has made grand promises regarding Judah. Especially, he has promised a great king from Judah. Whether it's Genesis 49, whether it's Psalm 2, whether it's Micah chapter 5, that's the promise. A great king's going to emerge from the line of Judah, from this nation. And if then God were a weather vane, then his purpose to bring forth a great king from Judah might conceivably change. It might change due to the winds of Judah's wicked behavior. God might just say, forget it, I'm not producing a great king from this people. But God's a rock, not a weather vane. The storm of moral depravity described in verses 2 to 4 might be crashing through Judah right now, but Habakkuk is confident that it can't sweep away Yahweh, and it can't sweep away Yahweh's purposes, and it can't sweep away Yahweh's promises, because Yahweh is a sturdy rock. He will remain resolved to bring forth that king, come what may. And that means that Judah cannot die with that king still to emerge. And you can apply this at the personal level. Sometimes in our Christian lives, we go through periods when the fierce storms of sin and backsliding rage. And perhaps we fear at times that everything has been swept away. All our hopes of heaven swept away. And at such points, we need to remember our God is a rock. Nothing sweeps him away. Not even our most violently reckless episodes sweep him away. He continues, still determined to save us completely. Still resolved to bring us to complete conformity to the Son of his love. It's a wonderful truth, isn't it? That we have this rock-like God whose purpose is for us. Even our moral fluctuations cannot change. And then the other title here is My Holy One. My Holy One. Which seems an odd title for Habakkuk to use in this connection, doesn't it? You might expect there, My Loving One, we shall not die. Surely that would fit better. I mean, if there's one aspect of God's character that suggest Judah could be finished off at this point because of her wickedness, it's God's holiness. Why is he talking about God's holiness and then saying, we shall not die? But I think we often have too narrow a conception of God's holiness. We associate God's holiness exclusively with purity and God's instincts to punish sin. And often in the Bible, holiness is associated with those things. But not always. Do you remember that great famous verse in Hosea? Hosea chapter 11 verse 9, where God's having threatened Israel with wiping her out, then suddenly changes his tone and says, I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. Why? For I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come in wrath. Again, the very reason God is saying why I'm not going to wipe you out for your sin is that I'm the Holy One. It seems nonsensical to us. But you see, God's holiness is his separateness. It's his distinctness from everything and everyone else. That's the raw basic meaning of his holiness. It means he's different. He's other. And that's the point there in Hosea 11 verse 9. God says, I'm not a man. A man, a human being, provoked in the way that you, Israel, are provoking me, would inevitably be overcome with wrath and would just finish everything. But I'm holy. I'm mysteriously different from men, from human beings. I don't conform to human norms. And so where no one else, no man, no angel, no God, where no one else would conceive of extending mercy to such a grossly rebellious people, I'm going to extend mercy because I'm different. I'm different. And I think that's the point here too then in Habakkuk 1 verse 12, where he says, we shall not die because you're holy, God. You're a different kind of being from any other. One who, even when his people are reeking of violence and perverted justice, can still find it in him to be forbearing. Believer, worship God for his holiness, his set apartness, the holiness and set apartness of his purity, yes, but also, and perhaps primarily, the holiness, the set-apartness of his grace. God is nowhere more holy than in his grace. Nowhere more holy than in his willingness to bear with wretched sinners. Nowhere more holy than when he forgives us again and again and again and again. No one else would do that. No one else would treat you like that. But he's holy, he's different, he's other. And so he treats you like that. Sing in wonder, believer. Who is a pardoning God like thee? Or who has grace so rich and free? So we must move on, but we're asking the question then, will Babylon mercilessly kill nations forever? And we're saying in the first instance, no, because of the nation that eludes Chaldean ambition. But then, secondly, will the Chaldeans mercilessly kill nations forever? No, because of the future that excludes Chaldean aggression. No, because of the future that excludes Chaldean aggression. Verse 14 is a very profound reflection, theological reflection by Habakkuk. He's reflecting on the fall, or perhaps more specifically, I suppose, on the curse that God imposed as a result of the fall. And he identifies there in verse 14 two aspects then of the curse. Number one, man ceases to rule over the fish and creeping things. That's what he says, isn't it? He refers to the fish and the creeping things, or the crawling things, that have no ruler. Now that's what man was supposed to be. He was supposed to be the ruler, wasn't he? Over everything else in creation, over the fish, over the crawling things. He was supposed to be this wise, careful, protective steward of them all. But now, because of the curse, he is no longer, they have no ruler, Habakkuk solemnly announces. And then the second aspect of the curse he identifies is that man resembles the unruled fish and crawling things. That's what he says, isn't it? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. So it's not just that man has ceased to rule over the rest of the creation and they have no ruler and are just exposed and defenseless, but man resembles them. Man resembles the fish and the crawling things, just exposed and at the prey of whatever predators come his way. And he's thinking then of, again, the Chaldeans and the nations. In the face of the Chaldeans, just no defense against them. The Chaldeans can rampage wherever they want, just plucking a people here and a people there. And there's no one to defend the nations. Like the fish, like the crawling things, man just so exposed and vulnerable and defenseless. So that's Habakkuk's reflection on a cursed world. But this is the thing, this theological heavyweight then, Habakkuk, he would also know that Genesis 1 was not the last time that scripture had portrayed the proper arrangement, man ruling over the whole creation, everything proper, everything in harmony. Habakkuk would know that the last scripture to talk about that was the one that we sang earlier in our service, Psalm 8. And Habakkuk may have had an inkling of what the writer to the Hebrews knew, as I explained to you earlier, that Psalm 8 is not a flashback. It's a forward-looking prophecy. It's looking ahead to a time when the curse will be undone and everything in God's creation will be as it should be. Which means then, in answer to verse 17's question, will the Chaldeans go on mercilessly killing nations forever? No, they won't. Because an age is coming when that kind of thing will not happen any longer. When brutal superpowers will not be able to go around wreaking havoc. When Chaldeans will not be able to go around, and Putin will not be able to go around doing that kind of thing. When human beings will no longer be these vulnerable, defenseless little things. But when everything will be right again. Man on the throne again. Creation harmonious again. Habakkuk may have some inkling of that, and certainly you and I, in the light of the New Testament, we have that hope. And is it a hope then? As I talked about in my earlier prayer, is it a hope that excites you? I said in my introduction that we should be concerned, we should be disturbed when we see violence and inhumanity and brutality in this world. When we see tyrants and despots who are reducing the lives of God's image bearers to misery. This should trouble us. It should hurt us. And it should drive us then to this great hope that Psalm 8 sets forth, that an age is coming when everything will be right again. And this creation will be set free and be as it should be. Look at what Habakkuk says at the beginning of verse 13. You are of purer eyes than to see evil. And that is why evil cannot possibly remain in this world indefinitely. Because God is of purer eyes than to keep on looking at it forever and ever and ever. For reasons that he keeps to himself, he chooses to keep looking at it for a time. But he cannot keep looking at evil forever. A time must come when it will be gone. Gone. Forevermore. That day prophesied by Micah. In Micah chapter 4, when nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more, but they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. That age must come, because God is of purer eyes than to look forever upon violence and bloodshed and butchery. And so, Christian, be full of hope. Be full of hope in a world of Chaldean savagery, that it will not go on forever, that there is a new heaven and a new earth coming when righteousness will prevail and peace will prevail and harmony will prevail. Look forward, believer, to that. So will the Chaldeans mercilessly kill nations forever? No, because of the nation that eludes Chaldean ambition. No, because of the future that excludes Chaldean aggression. But thirdly, will the Chaldeans kill nations forever? No, because of the man who eclipses Chaldean angling. Because of the man who eclipses Chaldean angling. It's a powerful image there, isn't it, in verse 15 of the Chaldeans as they go around killing all these nations. It's like an angler, like a fisherman, going round just with his nets, just pulling up a people here, a people there. It's a powerful image that Habakkuk is using. But this is the thing. One day, the Chaldeans will have to hand over the fishing rod to someone else. And you say, ah, yes, we know that. They will have to hand it over to the Persians, the next superpower that will come along, so that they can go around fishing the nations for their satisfaction and fulfillment. Well, yes, okay, but one day the Persians too will have to hand over the fishing rod. And you say, ah, yes, well, of course they will. They'll have to hand it over to the Greeks, the next superpower that comes along, so that they can then practice such violence and go around fishing nations right, left and centre. Well, yes, but the day will come when the Greeks too will have to hand over the fishing rod. You say, ah yes, they'll have to hand it over to the Romans. And the Romans then will be brutal, and they'll go around fishing for peoples everywhere. Well, yes, but one day the Romans will also have to hand over the fishing rod. And now you start racking your brains and trying to think, well, which empire will they hand over the fishing rod to? Well, I'll tell you into whose hands, or in whose hands, this fishing rod will end up. It will end up in the hands of Jesus Christ. Do you remember Jesus' language in Matthew chapter 4? It's so familiar that we perhaps barely stop to think what an odd picture it is that he uses there when he's calling his first disciples. And he says, you're going to join my mission, and we're going to go fishing. And we're going to go fishing for men. Fishing for human beings. And we sing our children's choruses about it. I will make you fishers of men. As though it's this lovely little picture. It's actually quite a disturbing image, isn't it? When you think that Jesus is almost certainly taking up the language of Habakkuk 1, verse 15. I mean, consciously taking up the language of Habakkuk 1, 15. Fishing men, that's what the Babylonians were doing. That's what superpowers did. And Jesus is saying, that's what I'm going to do. And you're going to be my instruments in it. Peter and Andrew and James and John. You see, Jesus is saying there in Matthew 4, he's saying something stupendous. He's saying there's a new angler on the world scene now. Someone else is now going to march through the nations of this world with a net. And it's me. Move over Babylon. Move over Persia. Move over Greece. Move over Rome. Your day's over now. You barely caught any fish at all in your nets. I am going to utterly eclipse you as I catch in my net more fish from more nations than you even knew existed. And that's been the story of the last 2,000 years. And it's a story that's still going on today. Jesus Christ is marching through this world with his fishing net, catching people, catching nations, catching tribes, catching peoples. We this evening in this room, most of us, are fish whom he has caught in his nets. But of course, whereas to be caught in the net of the Babylonians was a grim, grim, terrible thing indeed, to be caught in the net of Jesus Christ is the most wonderful thing in the world. There's not one of us here tonight who would choose to get back into the sea of our former godlessness and start swimming around there again. How thankful we are that there was a day in our lives when the great angler, the great fisherman came by and he grabbed us and he pulled us out of the water. And perhaps at the time we kicked and we screamed and we writhed like the fish you've seen being pulled out of Killingworth Lake or somewhere. But now with all our hearts we're glad that he pulled us out. He pulled us out. He's this very different fisherman from all those superpowers that preceded him. But one thing he has in common with them. Look at verse 15 where it says that he, that is the Chaldean fisherman, he rejoices and is glad. And so does Jesus Christ rejoice and be glad. And he will catch more fish today. There'll be more fish in his net by the end of today than there were at the beginning of today. And at the end of this Lord's Day, he will take his net with new fish into the presence of his Father. And he will say, look, Father, I've got new fish in this net. And there are these fish here from New Zealand, and these fish here from South America, and these fish here from Newcastle in the United Kingdom. And he will have such relish showing his Father these fish he's caught. He'll rejoice and be glad because every fish matters to him, and he loves his fish. That's this great fisherman, Jesus Christ. And so, if you're not a Christian tonight, my prayer for you is that you'll be caught one day soon. That the greater than the Babylonians, the greater than the Romans, the greater than every superpower, Jesus Christ will come by and will catch you and pull you into his net. And if you are a Christian tonight, thank God that he caught you. Thank God that you're in his net. Thank God that he pulled you out of the sea of your lost estate. Thank God that Jesus Christ will go on marching through this world catching fish until all the fish he's going to catch have been caught. And he will rejoice and be glad over every single one of them. May God bless his word. Amen.